Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the battlefronts in this space, for sure, is North Korea. And there are a few people in America who have studied it more closely and contributed, I think, with greater effect to not only our military and intelligence community's understanding of the challenge we face from the Kim dynasty in North Korea, but what is at work at the moment as President Trump seeks to denuclearize the regime of Kim Jong-un. His name is Dr. Bruce Bechtel. He has been active both in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps and in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and now is a professor of political science at Angelo State University, in documenting what is afoot in the so-called Herbert Kingdom. He is the author of numerous books on the subject, including one brand new one, I'm very pleased to say. It's entitled North Korean Military Proliferation in the Middle East and Africa, Enabling Violence and Instability. Bruce Bechtel, thank you so much for coming on. We have a limited time to introduce this very important subject today, but we're looking forward to having you back for a longer visit in the very new future. But congratulations on North Korean Military Proliferation. It's a book that has long been needed, and I'm delighted that you've presented it. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show, Frank. You're one of my very favorite people to interview with.
Well, thank you. And the feeling's mutual. So, Bruce, let's talk a little bit about what the North Koreans have done to bring to numerous places around the world the kind of instability and danger that the regime in North Korea has long represented in its own region.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because countries that are unstable and have ongoing violence are exactly the countries that North Korea targets for their arms sales. So we see that North Korea, which has better capabilities than many give them credit for, you know, missiles, obviously, they proliferated their nuclear program to Syria and probably to Iran, training of special operations forces, that kind of stuff. It goes to Iran to the tune of $2 to $3 billion a year. Chemical weapons sales to a country like Syria. The latest UN panel of experts report that came out in August but was never released, still hasn't been released. In the copy of the report that I got, it said, and I'm quoting, not paraphrasing, chemical weapons proliferation from North Korea to Syria continues unabated. And of course, then we see a lot of it going to places like Africa as well. Over a dozen countries, Frank, that I document in the book, everything from small arms to special forces training to even missiles in the case of Egypt. So this is a big issue, and it's something that helps maintain their economy and keeps the sanctions at bay, because they're making billions with a B a year off of these arms sales.
Well, explore that with us a little bit further, because it's been a mystery for some time, apart from the Chinese subventions, how this regime manages to support itself. Obviously, it's done it on the backs of its own people, who it's literally starved to death. But you've made the argument in your new book, Bruce Bechtel, that there is a whole sort of criminal enterprise of which proliferation is just one manifestation, that is essentially propping up this regime. Is that right?
Yes, that's very true. You put it quite well, Frank. You know, there's a bunch of activities besides just proliferation. Proliferation is probably the biggest, probably about anywhere from 60 to 70% of their overall illicit activities, but they sell illicit drugs, you know, even things such as illegal rhino horns from Africa and things like this. They'll sell anything to anybody who will buy it. And so we're talking about billions of dollars a year, which for them is a lot of money, that goes through arms sales and all these other illicit activities into front companies and banks that are in second party nations. In other words, the North Koreans are using people from other nations to help them launder the dirty money and then back to North Korea on investments in places like Europe, Singapore, Vietnam, China, etc. This is something that helps maintain the regime. These billions of dollars don't only help the regime and help them develop their nuclear and other WMD programs, but they help Kim Jong-un to keep the elite happy, buying them Mercedes, keeping them in nice apartments, etc.
Yeah. Counterfeiting is another activity that they've engaged in, including apparently very high quality counterfeit American currency over the years. I don't know whether the techniques that the Bureau of Engraving has engaged in to try to discourage that sort of thing is cut into their profits. But again, Bruce Bechtel, what this is doing is all suggesting that President Trump's efforts to negotiate in good faith the obvious desirable end state of a nuclear weapons-free Korean Peninsula, specifically North Korea, because the South is already nuclear weapons free, is not likely, is it, when you have this kind of, criminal racketeering enterprise at its core?
Well, I concur with you. And as you know, if they are going to dismantle their nuclear program, that would also have to include proliferation, which is now proven. Specifically to Syria. We all know about what happened in 2007 with Syria. It's very important that, yes, Iran, and I outline that in my chapter on Iran, exactly how many sources that I use and the different times that they have proliferated nuclear technology to Iran, because there's many American scholars still arguing against that, which in my mind is just silly. But, you know, if we're going to go after the proliferation networks, to go after the snake, you have to go after the head. And the best way to do that, in my mind, and as I articulate in the book, is to go after those illicit front companies, the banks, and all of the second party people in all of those places, China, Singapore, Africa, the Middle East, etc. Go after those people. That's what Trump can do and has started partially doing that already. That is going to have to be part of a heavy pressure campaign if the upcoming talks don't go well.
Well, the one other piece of this, and again, we need another hour to discuss this in depth with you, Bruce Bechtel, and thank you for agreeing in principle to do that. We'll get you back soon. But I'm very concerned that at the same time that it's apparent that the president's good efforts are being met by continued intransigence by the North Korean regime, the South Korean government seems to be pursuing rather aggressively a separate peace with the North, which at the very minimum is undermining the president's efforts and, I'm afraid, creating conditions under which Kim Jong-un may return to the family business, as I call it, the dangerous aggression. Bruce, we have to leave it at that, my friend. Thank you so much for your time today. Let's visit again soon. And again, congratulations on this important new book, North Korean Military Proliferation in the Middle East and Africa, Enabling Violence and Instability. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're delighted to be joined by Gordon Chang, one of the featured regulars of our program and rock stars of the national security and foreign policy community. You see him frequently at Fox News. I'm sure you read him at the Daily Beast or the National Interest. But most especially, we're delighted that you see him or hear him at least here each week. Gordon Chang is, of course, the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, we were talking a moment ago with Bruce Bechtel about the threat from North Korea, which persists and abides. But I wanted to spend our time with you talking a bit about the threat from its, well, patron, China. There are a number of things that are developing. It seems almost every day now, a new development suggesting that amidst growing economic turmoil in China and political repercussions thereof, Xi Jinping, the president, is increasingly ratcheting up bellicose rhetoric, whether it's towards Taiwan or it would appear towards us as well. Talk us through what's going on the ground in China at the moment, where trade talks are underway as we speak, and what you think we should make of these rhetorical developments, if not facts on the ground.
Xi Jinping has been talking a lot in a bellicose fashion. On January 2nd, he marked the 40th anniversary of a message that Beijing sent to Taiwan. And in it, his big applause line was, look, we do not renounce the use of force. And it was clear that that was his message to the people of Taipei. And this follows, or this preceded by a day or so, the first order of 2019 to the People's Liberation Army, which is prepare for war. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, of course armies prepare for war. But the point is there's context. There's a context of these other bellicose statements. We've had statements from PLA officers in December urging surprise attacks on the U.S. Navy. And there's a lot that's going on inside China, which is distressing. There is obviously infighting at the top of the Communist Party. They postponed the fourth plenum of the Central Committee. That was a surprise. Also, we're getting some pretty gruesome economic numbers indicating that the Chinese economy may be growing under 2%. A Renmin University professor a couple of weeks ago created a sensation across China when he said that the economy was growing no faster than 1.67% and could even be contracting. There's a lot going on, Frank. We don't know exactly what it means, but when you hear all of these bellicose words, you got to be extremely concerned.
Well, especially, Gordon, as you know, totalitarian systems have long had a penchant for seeking to relieve pressure from increasingly aggrieved domestic audiences over the repression they're experiencing by saying, well, we need to pull together because of the foreign threat that we're facing, even if that means precipitating, you know, a conflict with a manufactured foreign threat. Do you see in the comments about Taiwan or the comments about prepare for war or even the statements of these now two, I believe, senior military officers to the effect that China should launch a surprise attack against the United States Navy, that we're entering a period in which that kind of effort to relieve the domestic pressure might be engineered by the Chinese Communist Party?
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility, Frank. There are a couple things. First of all, China just could lash out to create the foreign enemy, as you talk about. I think that Chinese leaders are starting to see a closing window of opportunity. You know, if you go back to 2017, these guys thought they were going to rule the world in short order. Now they're understanding their vulnerabilities. I think Xi Jinping might be looking out at the rest of the globe and saying, oh my gosh, we've got to act fast. And one of the reasons is you've got the economy, which is now trending downward very, very fast. You've got demography, which appears to be in accelerated decline with some comments from Chinese demographers in the last week or so that are actually quite frightening. You have the environment, of course, that is putting a limit on how far China can develop. You've got social unrest, which in 2018 you saw across the political spectrum and across Chinese society. Xi Jinping has got to believe that he's besieged and he's got to do something. And it means that they can create an incident, or they could back themselves into one by, you know, for instance, these aggressive encounters against the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force. There's a whole multitude of things that could go wrong, but the law of averages says something will go terribly wrong.
Gordon, walk us through this demography bit, because, of course, China, as we've talked about over the years, has pursued what was once called the one-child policy. Relatively recently, they've modified that to a two-child policy. But the repercussions of decades of basically forced abortions and the sex selection of children to ensure that they were males, not females, is a case of chickens coming home to roost. You're saying that there's evidence that this is an even more pronounced problem, one that is emerging as critical to the society, perhaps, because there won't be the young people to support the aging population, than had previously been anticipated?
Yes. Some Chinese demographers are saying that the country's population as a whole peaked in 2017. We're going to get the 2018 births and death numbers pretty soon. I don't know if it actually did hit the high point 2017, but it's occurring much faster than people projected, because official projections are that China won't peak until the late part of next decade, 2028, maybe even later. So this would be a decade, a full decade before current projections. Also, this tracks something that people often forget about, and that is if you go into the middle part of last decade, the official projections were that the workforce, which is the cohort of population between 15 and 60, would peak in 2016. In fact, the National Bureau of Statistics, which is official, said that the Chinese workforce peaked in 2011. A half decade in front of projections. So we have accelerated demographic decline. If you can ever have a crisis in demography, this is it. And Chinese leaders have got to understand something that is really important from their perspective, and that is within 5 years or so, China, for the first time in at least 300 years, maybe even all of recorded history, will not be the world's most populous country. It will be India, a country that they both fear and disdain. So this is, I think, a psychological turning point for the Chinese.
Wow. Gordon, just a quick question before we get back to sort of what this all means politically, domestically, and geostrategically. Do you have confidence in any of the data that the Chinese government produces? I know you've expressed skepticism about their manipulating their economic information that they disclose about their growth rates and productivity and so on. But what about population? Wouldn't they be equally inclined to manipulate that data?
Yeah, that's a great question, Frank. We don't know exactly what's going on with China's demographic numbers. And I don't even think that China's central leaders know. As Deng Xiaoping once famously said, you know, on population numbers, you know, some people want to increase them and some people want to decrease them. And we have little idea here in Beijing what the real number is. And I think that there's a couple of things going on. One of them is that China is a big place, so data collection is going to be inherently hard. But also because there are political imperatives, that does skew population data. And that's why, you know, there are all of these disagreements and wide disagreements among Chinese demographers, who I think some of them are actually quite sincere in what they say. It's just there's a real question about the underlying raw data.
Yeah. You know, we've talked about this in the past as well, Gordon. Reggie Littlejohn, who is one of my favorite gurus on these matters in China, has made the point that the Chinese actually have got an unbelievably detailed knowledge of the status of, well, to put it graphically, women's wombs across the country, because this has been part and parcel of the Communist Party's control mechanism for enforcing the one-child policy, now modified somewhat. Therefore, presumably, the inputs to the data about the population, certainly the population that is aborting, is pretty precise. But one would think that the social credit score mechanisms that are being imposed to monitor everything from, you know, what you eat to what you think is also going to be providing them pretty precise data on these sorts of issues. But maybe that's not being faithfully transferred to the rest of us in terms of their public data. But Gordon, just back to the question of what does all this mean? You mentioned the fourth plenum of the Central Committee being postponed. That sounds like pretty inside baseball. Does this suggest that Xi Jinping's political hold on power is really in jeopardy. And after, you know, his coronation as the president for life, could things be so quickly turned around?
Yeah, I think so, Frank. Now, there is disagreement among China watchers. Some people say that Xi Jinping just postponed the fourth plenum because he didn't need it. And they point to Mao Zedong doing the same thing. I actually think, though, there's more evidence suggesting that he postponed the fourth plenum because he couldn't get consensus. He couldn't get the answers that he wanted. And, you know, you look at, for instance, his speech marking the 40th anniversary of the third plenum of the 11th Central Committee, which is the event that most people consider to be the start of China's reform era. It was contentless. And that suggests Xi Jinping was skirting over a lot of issues because there was extreme disagreement among the senior leaders in the Central Committee. So, I mean, there's a lot of inside baseball here. People can disagree, but obviously things are happening that we have not seen in a very long time.
Gordon Chang, as always, your help in helping the rest of us understand the importance of preparedness, vis-a-vis the Chinese especially, is greatly appreciated. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us again next week.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's my pleasure to say, joined for the first time by Todd Binsman. He is the Senior National Security Fellow for one of my favorite organizations, the Center for Immigration Studies. He has a very interesting background. For the past 9 years or so, he has been directly involved in border security, specifically in his native Texas, where he worked in its Department of Public Safety, heading up teams of intelligence analysts working in the Intelligence and Counterterrorism Division, specifically trying to find and intercept and neutralize those who may be coming across our southern border into Texas wishing to do us harm, terrorists, jihadists, whatever you want to call them. These are the sorts of people that there is reason to believe are still coming across that border. And indeed, Todd has just returned from a trip to Panama, where he had an opportunity to do some stock taking of what's the nature of that threat, as well as what a friendly government, we're told, in Panama is doing perhaps to exacerbate it. But interestingly enough, Todd has also got a previous life and background in journalism as a prize-winning reporter for places like the Dallas Morning News, CBS, and Hearst newspapers, and therefore is an extraordinarily impressive purveyor of the facts, as well as a man with deep subject matter expertise. And we're very pleased to have him here with us for the first time. Todd, welcome. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks. Happy New Year. Great intro.
Thank you. Well, listen, your appearance on Fox News on the 31st of December caught my attention because you were talking not only about the reality that is often dismissed or denied by people here in Washington in the middle of this debate about border security and the need for a wall and so on, namely that there are people coming here who we have every reason to believe have in mind doing us harm. But you also shed light on what Panama and, for that matter, Costa Rica are doing that may be exacerbating the problem. Walk us through that, if you would, Todd.
Yeah, sure. And it's a little bit frustrating to watch Fox News. I was watching yesterday Chris Wallace again repeat this canard that no terrorists have ever reached the border, that southern border. And, you know, if he'd have watched his own programming just a few days earlier, he might have seen differently or read anything that the Center for Immigration Studies has published recently.
Or for that matter, the Homeland Security Committee of the House of Representatives, which has also issued a recent report on the subject.
Which just recently, as a parting shot, and the Democrats took over and immediately scrubbed the site of it. It's still out there, though. But I went to Panama because it had become a point of national contention whether terrorists were traveling through Latin America, initially along with the migrant caravans, but just in generally. Middle Easterners and people from countries of terrorism concern were making their way to the border. And there was, like you said, a lot of denialism. There still is, as Chris Wallace showed yesterday. that this is happening or how it's happening. We had a president in office who was talking about this. I'd never heard a president talk about this. And that's sort of what sparked it all. So the center sent me down to Panama. Mainly, I chose Panama because that's a bottleneck country where migrants from all over the world are funneling through from South America on the route. And by all over the world, what I mean is the countries of the Middle East, the countries of South Asia, like Pakistan and Afghanistan, Iran, and the Horn of Africa, like Somalia and Eritrea and Sudan. Those kind of migrants are moving through South America and through Panama. And that would be the best place to potentially see them, witness them, and talk to officials in and around that problem set, that threat set.
Well, put differently, it's a perfect place to stop them too, isn't it? But that doesn't seem to be happening as a result of government policy in Panama. Tell us about this controlled flow policy of the Panamanian government.
Yeah, sure. So what I found, it was a surprise because I was expecting something else. But in the last year and a half, 2 years, the situation changed in the migrant flow. It once was that you came through the jungle from South America, Colombia, into Panama, and then smugglers would move you through Panama City through a network of safe houses and stash houses, and, you know, by cars and truck and, you know, hiding in the backs and the trunks and that sort of thing. And the Panamanian government decided to do something different a couple of years ago, and that's controlled flow. Now, instead of trying to interdict and break up the smuggling organizations, the government has become the smuggler. And they have become the smuggler in conjunction with the Costa Rican government, too. So between Colombia and Nicaragua is a kind of a free flowing conveyor belt, I guess, or an assembly line of migrants. The way that works out is the Panamanian military collects these migrants in the jungle. The migrants all know about this, of course, so now they seek out the police, turn themselves in. They're taken care of very well in camps, provided with access to Western Union money and communication services, food, medical attention, and all the rest of that. And then they get transit passes. And once they have their transit passes, their money, and they're all rested up, the government puts them on buses, commercial buses, and make sure that they get safely to the Costa Rican border. And at the Costa Rican border, it's wash, rinse, and repeat all the way to the Nicaraguan border. So once I got on the ground and realized that the stash house system wasn't happening anymore, certain intelligence friends of mine told me, you know, where to go and how to find what was happening, how to actually see what was happening. And that was the migrant camps, where the Panamanians bring them, and then also a border town called Paso Canoas. And that's where the Panamanians do the handoff of busloads of these migrants from the Middle East and elsewhere to the Costa Ricans, and there's a processing center there.
Okay, so you saw firsthand evidence of the so-called special interest countries' people in these camps. As I recall from your interview on Fox, you actually were able to confirm that some of them were pulled out of the pool by the Costa Rican authorities, if not the Panamanians, on the grounds that they were not just, you know, from places that were problematic, but were actually associated with terrorism as well, personally. Is that correct?
That is correct. So here's what I saw. I actually met and photographed and videotaped many, many dozens of migrants from places like Pakistan and Iran and Bangladesh. These are called special interest aliens. I met them and I saw them and I walked amongst them and I interviewed a number of them on camera and also on video. And the results of my video interviews and audio interviews are on our CIS website. So that's number one. Let nobody say that Middle Easterners are not migrating through Latin America. That's just a canard, and it's demonstrably untrue. And they're doing it in large numbers, maybe 700 a week. coming through.
What, as they say, could possibly go wrong that you've got people coming in from Iran, Lebanon, Pakistan? By the way, what was the demographic? Were these women and children that you were interviewing primarily?
The special interest aliens from, you know, the countries that I described earlier were 100% young military-aged men with no women and no children. There were women and children among this group, but they were mostly from Haiti. They were Haitian. And then there were a few mixed in from Cuba as well. But the majority of these were from places like Sri Lanka and Pakistan, lots of Pakistanis.
And just to the specific question, Todd Bensman, there were some that were identified by the Costa Ricans, at least, as actual terrorists. Is that right?
That's right. So here's the way that works, is that the American Homeland Security presence in Panama, which is significant, ICE has agents down there and analysts in the embassies, and then also back in places like San Diego and Washington and Texas, they all work together with military intelligence on programs that the American public knows nothing about, because they are convinced and have always been persuaded that this is a threat that they can't ignore. They have to pay attention to this traffic. Because the second they look away and something happens, you know what happens then, right? There's congressional heads roll and all the rest of it.
Suddenly everyone's very concerned about border security when that goes down.
That's right. But thankfully, you know, our Homeland Security people are on this problem in that area, and they've adapted to this controlled flow policy. The way they've adapted to it is that they have equipped the Panamanians and the Costa Ricans with what's called BitMap, which is a program to collect biometric information, identity information from each and every one of these migrants that volunteer to go through the controlled flow system. So they get their eye retinal scan, their fingerprints, their, you know, photographs for facial recognition and all of that. And I actually watched that happening for hours on end. I saw the Costa Ricans do it and use the information. What happens with that information is it goes straight to the Americans. The Americans run that data against terrorism databases, prior terrorism information, intelligence. And occasionally they get a hit that this guy's fingerprints match the IED that was found in Iraq. That's something like that. And when that happens, they have the Costa Ricans or the Panamanians pull them off the line and interview them, and then the Americans will come in and interrogate.
Todd, we are hard out of time. I look forward to a longer conversation with you very soon on this. Thank you for your time today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by Charles Sam Faddis, a man of extraordinary accomplishment in the clandestine services of the United States Central Intelligence over the years. He was, for some 20 of those years, an operations officer in places like the Middle East and South Asia and Europe. Notably, he took the first CIA team into Iraq in 2002. He also served there as the former chief of station. He has been the chief of the Central Intelligence Agency's Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit. He's an attorney by training, among other things. He's an author. He has run for Congress. He is these days contributing mightily to the public policy debate, notably through And Magazine, where we can catch up with him on video, which is a real treat. Sam, it's great to catch up with you here at Secure Freedom Radio, too. Thanks for coming back. Good to talk with you. Happy New Year.
Pleasure to be here as always. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Well, one of your recent vlogs, I guess they're called, is about what you call Uber for Migrants, which happens to be very much of a piece with the conversation we were just having with Tom Benzman about the insecurity of our border. But you're looking at it from the perspective of what are we doing to our Border Patrol officers who are, in a way, in the absence of a wall, the first lines of defense down there. Talk about that.
Right. Well, so, you know, I think most people have this vision that, okay, we got the migrants out there and they're hiding from the Border Patrol and the Border Patrol's trying to ferret them out, which is, there's definitely some truth to that. But we now have turned this whole thing kind of upside down in this bizarro universe. We've now constructed at our expense a whole system of hundreds of what are called rescue beacons across the desert. So if you're a migrant and you just kind of get tired of the whole game of trying to hide from the Border Patrol, you just find one of these beacons. There's a placard on it in multiple languages, including, interestingly enough, Chinese. And you press a button, and then you sit down and you wait, and it summons the Border Patrol, who then come and pick you up and take you in. And then, in effect, typically, if you're not a Mexican, what happens is you get a cot for a couple of nights and a shower, and you get fed, and then they give you a bus ticket and drop you off and hand you a piece of paper that says, hey, eventually there'll be a hearing and we trust you to show up on your own recognizance, and you're done. So in effect, if you work through that logically, yeah, we've now, Border Patrol is now Uber. You just press a button, they'll pick you up and do all the hard part for you.
Put you, in other words, on the fast track to life in our country, which is a magnet, let's face it, for more people to want to come here. This is complicated further, Sam, by the fact that some number of these folks are not in very good shape, not only as a result of the rigors of getting across deserts or other hostile territory to get here, but many of them have diseases, some of which we haven't seen in this country for a long time. How's the Border Patrol coping with that particular problem? We've heard about a couple of youngsters who've perished, unfortunately, as they came into our custody. But how serious a problem is this, as you would see it, not only for the law enforcement agents on the front lines, but for public health and safety as well?
Well, it's a huge problem because, as you've just said, you're talking about God knows what diseases that have been largely eradicated here. But, you know, before we get to that, there's just a massive expense issue here. You show up as a migrant, press this magic button, are transported to our detention center. We have now assumed the cost of treating you for whatever disease you have and for whatever damage you did to yourself in the course of crossing the border. I read an article the other day about a lady who had been climbing the fence down near San Diego, where it's pretty tall, fell, messed up her legs, was then transported to this shock trauma unit where she's hospitalized for weeks and weeks and weeks getting top-of-the-line care, again, all at our expense. And all I can think when I look at all of this is how many communities there are across the United States where life expectancy is in fact plummeting, where hospitals are closing, where there's no real medical care. And U.S. tax dollars are not paying for that. But this Salvadorian woman who broke our laws and threw herself off a fence will now go through surgery after surgery, and American taxpayers will pay for it.
Something's wrong here, that's for sure. And I personally am very much of the view that the president's right to be holding the line as he is on getting this border secured. And I appreciate your analysis and insights into the stakes. Let me ask you about some other very hot topics that you've got some personal experience with. Afghanistan, I believe you spent some time there. I know your son did. Indeed, he was wounded in the Marine Corps in Afghanistan. What do you make of the fact that at the moment the United States is apparently negotiating with the Taliban on the terms by which they will presumably come back into government as part of some sort of accommodation with the government we've been supporting in Afghanistan now for some 17 years?
Yeah, just to be crystal clear, my son did serve in Afghanistan, and I've worked the problem from the Pakistani side of the border.
That's where a big part of the problem turns out to be, isn't it?
It is sometimes the bigger part of the problem. I am all for the fact that we should stop trying to turn Afghanistan into Switzerland and Central Asia, and that we have gone down any number of rabbit holes that, in terms of nation building, if that's the correct term, that are not central to our national security. So a solution that is much less than perfect, I think, is exactly what we're going to end up with. Somewhere between that and abject surrender, though, there is a clear line. There is a line that we cannot cross, which on the other side of which is we basically bug out and concede defeat. And then not only do we abandon Afghanistan to its fate, but we will have poured jet fuel on every jihadi fire all over the world because we will have been seen to have been beaten. So we cannot cross that line. And I am concerned, as I think you are, about exactly where we are in that respect right now. If we are negotiating a withdrawal in the sense that we negotiated a withdrawal from South Vietnam, then we are in the wrong place.
And we're certainly dealing with the wrong people, much as we were with the Vietnamese communists. Let me ask you, Sam, because, again, this is something you're considerably more expert in than most of us. The idea of having a much smaller American footprint, but much greater combat capability than big army has produced in Afghanistan by adopting a technique that my friend Eric Prince says is modeled after the old British East India Company. Some call it mercenaries, some call it contractors, but to use retired special forces and agency personnel, both our own and from elsewhere, to essentially train up and help backstop an improved Afghan military with air power and intelligence and the like, but without anything like the American presence that we currently have, or investment for that matter. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as you and I think have discussed before, I get sensitive when we start talking about mercenaries. And I think that term often gets used in a very imprecise manner and has a connotation that I don't think Prince really intends it to.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he uses that term, needless to say.
That's the perfect way to put it. It's not a term that he uses. It's applied to him. So, I mean, I certainly think this needs to remain something that's under the control of the U.S. government. A lighter footprint, an unconventional way of approaching this, I think is not only appropriate in Afghanistan, but elsewhere. I love the United States military. My dad was a military officer. I was. My brother's a retired colonel, et cetera. There are plenty of conflicts like this where a conventional approach is not the answer. It is the wrong tool for the job. It soaks up a lot of resources. It's logistics heavy. It generates a lot of opposition. And in the end, often you're not really getting, you know, pound for pound what you need. A much leaner, more unconventional approach that makes the enemy pay, I think, is exactly where we want to be.
Yeah. Sam Faddis, much more to talk about. I hope we'll be able to do so with you in the very near future. Thank you for what you're doing and magazine. Come back to us again very soon. And I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.